The mechanisms enforcing this modern censorship are not confined to private sectors or individual platforms, but are significantly directed and influenced by the U.S. government itself. This intertwining of state powers with censorship activities marks a troubling departure from traditional American values, where free speech has been held sacred. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know, and we are diving into it today. This show is brought to you by Swan Bitcoin and CoinKite. Swan Bitcoin is the place to buy and plug your life into the Bitcoin world, and CoinKite are the makers of the Cold Card hardware wallet and the Cold Card Q, now with a full keyboard, the Cypherpunk BlackBerry, and to protect your Bitcoin. And now actually so much more. I am really jazzed about the Q. I don't have it yet, but it's on the way. But anyway, I got a bunch of tags and or private DMs of people telling me about the article that we are going to read today. And it's really good. I really appreciate that suggestion. Just to let you guys know, the quote-unquote marketing of this show relies on you guys just sharing it out in word of mouth. So anything that you can do there is a wonderful one, like a huge help. Like it is literally the entirety of how this show grows. And then the other side of it is that so much of this show is built around your suggestions. I love suggestions because it just means that filtering, it's basically a built-in form of filtering for me. Many, many episodes of this show are from just realizing what you guys want to hear or the questions you have or where something didn't quite line up or an article that you read or that you wanted to read, but Jesus, it was way too long. Maybe I can send it to Guy. Do not feel bad about doing that because that actually saves me time from having to get on X or whatever and then get caught up and distracted in a whole bunch of other crap instead of when I'm just actually looking for articles. So know that both of those things are basically the two different sides of this show with all of the work that me and the team do in between. So you guys are literally the beginning and the end of that process, and a massive thank you to those who do participate. And don't feel shy if you want to help, suggest, whatever. Shoot me a message. All right, but this article is by Dr. Joseph Mercola, which I'm sure many of you know the name, blew up because he was being censored when he was talking about the absurdity of the policies and actions taken from the political sphere and the bureaucracies during 2020, during COVID, and then also pulling together and making sense of the data for the damage and harm being done by the injection that shall not be named so that this podcast doesn't get removed. So with that, let's get into today's read about the censorship industrial complex, about the growing and festering, quote, whole society solution of a censorship and narrative control technological stack. How is it forming and how in the hell do we prevent this from leading us to an awful future? And it's titled, "The National Security State is the Main Driver of Censorship in the U.S." by Dr. Joseph Mercola. The story at a glance. In a February 16, 2024 interview, Tucker Carlson and Mike Benz discussed how the fundamental right to free speech in the United States, as guaranteed by the First Amendment, is being eroded. Not based on truthfulness, but on alignment with the political and social agendas of those in power. Modern censorship is not as overt as historical examples. Instead, societal, technological, and political means are being used to subtly integrate censorship into daily life. Initially a tool for freedom, the internet has been transformed into a mechanism for controlling speech, with government bodies, the defense industry, and tech companies developing sophisticated methods for online suppression. New laws and institutional arrangements, both in the U.S. and internationally, such as the EU Digital Services Act, have created frameworks that legalize and formalize online censorship. Government, the private sector, civil society, and media institutions are all working together to shape and control the narrative. To combat their whole-of-society censorship effort, we need a whole-of-society plan of our own that includes restructuring the legislative, civil, and media landscapes to promote true freedom. In a February 16, 2024 interview, Tucker Carlson and Mike Benz, founder and executive director of the Foundation for Freedom Online, discussed the erosion of free speech. The fundamental right to free speech is at risk. As noted by Carlson, freedom of speech, as outlined in the First Amendment to the Bill of Rights, is being eroded, not based on the truthfulness of information, but whether it aligns with the agendas and narratives of those in power. This right, which has been central to the identity and exceptionalism of the United States since its inception, ensures that people can express their thoughts and beliefs without fear of censorship or persecution. This right is what distinguishes us as free individuals opposed to slaves. And as noted by Carlson, there is no hate speech exception in the First Amendment.
There's no hate speech exception to that. Just because you hate what somebody else thinks, you cannot force that person to be quiet because we're citizens, not slaves.
Carlson also points out that while censorship itself is nothing new, the censorship we face today is very different from other historical instances. It's a far more nuanced, multifaceted approach that includes societal, technological, and political dimensions. Moreover, this new form of censorship is being subtly integrated into the very fabric of our daily lives, which makes it all the more insidious and difficult to combat. The phenomenon of labeling undesirable yet truthful information as, quote, malinformation is but one example of this. This labeling process, devoid of concern for the factual accuracy or the honesty of the expressed views, undermines the essence of free speech by restricting open discourse based on subjective criteria rather than objective truth. Importantly, the mechanisms enforcing this modern censorship are not confined to private sectors or individual platforms, but are significantly directed and influenced by the U.S. government itself. This intertwining of state powers with censorship activities marks a troubling departure for traditional American values, where free speech has been held sacred. While many intuitively perceive this shift, Carlson suspects they may not fully grasp the mechanics of this censorship, or just how deeply embedded it has become in the societal and political landscape. This lack of understanding further compounds the risk, as combating an unseen or poorly comprehended threat is far more challenging. Modern censorship mechanics explained. According to Benz, modern censorship is based on a complex integrated system where government interests, military defense strategies, and corporate technologies converge to regulate and restrict free speech. Moving us away from the foundational ideals of internet freedom and openness toward a more controlled and surveilled communication landscape. In the interview, he outlines the transformation from internet freedom to internet censorship and how these changes have been influenced and directed by various government agencies and the military-industrial complex. Initially, the internet was heralded as a tool of freedom, promoting open dialogue and the exchange of ideas across borders. This freedom was supported and even exploited by entities like the Pentagon, the State Department, and intelligence services to advance U.S. interests abroad, particularly in facilitating regime change by supporting dissident groups in authoritarian countries. However, this perspective has shifted dramatically in the past decades. According to Benz, the change began with the realization within U.S. and allied defense and intelligence communities that the same tools that promote freedom and regime change abroad could also be used against them, which led to a significant shift from promoting to restricting speech online.
2014, when there began to be an about-face on internet freedom and its utility. Now, the high watermark of the sort of internet free speech moment was the Arab Spring in 2011, 2012, when you had this one by one, all of the adversary governments of the Obama administration, Egypt, Tunisia, all began to be toppled in Facebook revolutions and Twitter revolutions. And you had the State Department working very closely with the social media companies to be able to keep social media online during those periods. There's a famous phone call from Google's Jared Cohen to Twitter to not do their scheduled maintenance so that the preferred opposition group in Iran would be able to use Twitter to win that election. So it was free speech was an instrument of statecraft from the national security state to begin with. All of that architecture, all the NGOs, the relationships between the tech companies and the national security state had been long established for freedom. In 2014, after the coup in Ukraine, there was an unexpected counter coup where Crimea and the Donbass broke away. And they broke away with essentially a military backstop that NATO was highly unprepared for at the time. They had one last Hail Mary chance, which was the Crimea annexation vote in 2014. And when the hearts and minds of the people of Crimea voted to join the Russian Federation, that was the last straw for the concept of free speech on the internet in the eyes of NATO. As they saw it, the fundamental nature of war changed at that moment. And NATO at that point declared something that they first called the Gerasimov Doctrine, which is named after this Russian military general who they claimed made a speech that the fundamental nature of war has changed. You don't need to win military skirmishes to take over Central and Eastern Europe. All you need to do is control the media and the social media ecosystem, because that's what controls elections. And if you simply get the right...
Censorship is now embedded into the internet infrastructure. The mechanics of modern censorship, as described by Benz, involve a coordinated effort between governmental bodies, the defense industry, and tech companies to develop and implement sophisticated methods to monitor, control, and suppress speech online under the guise of combating, quote, disinformation and malinformation for national security purposes. But again, these efforts are not necessarily concerned with the veracity of the information, but rather its alignment with or opposition to certain political agendas, both national and global. These censorship mechanisms are now embedded within the very infrastructure of the internet itself, from social media platforms to search engines and tools initially developed to protect democracy and promote free speech, such as VPNs, Tor, encryption, and private browsing modes, have all been repurposed to monitor and control the flow of information instead. The involvement of major tech corporations, initially funded and supported by government grants and contracts, plays a crucial role in this transformation. For example, Google began as a project funded by a Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, grant, awarded to founders Larry Page and Sergey Brin while they were PhD students at Stanford. This funding was part of a joint CIA and NSA program aimed at understanding how groups form and interact online, essentially tracking, quote, birds of a feather through search engine data aggregation. That technology is now being used to identify, monitor, and silence dissident voices within the U.S., no matter how righteous their views may be. Legal frameworks now sustain modern censorship. Benz also reviews the legal and institutional frameworks established to sustain this modern censorship, which allows for a seamless transition between state objectives and private sector compliance. This public-private interaction is a clear departure from the overt government censorship of old. What we now have is a far more nuanced, shadowy form of content control that blurs the lines between public and private actions against free speech. As we saw during the COVID pandemic, this also allowed government to plead innocence and pretend that the decision to censor some content was done by the companies themselves. However, between the Twitter files, the CTIL files, and the lawsuit against the Biden administration, we now have ample evidence showing that companies were pressured to comply with the government's demand for censorship. They didn't come up with that on their own. According to Benz, it's quite clear that state-sponsored initiatives supported by defense and intelligence agencies are shaping online narratives and controlling information flow in the U.S. under the pretense that national security is at stake. As such, these initiatives have led to a form of legalized censorship. U.S.-led initiatives have also influenced internet governance and free speech regulations internationally. For example, the European Union's Digital Services Act, or DSA, is a significant legislative move towards formalizing and legalizing online censorship. The DSA, which took effect February 17, 2024, requires tech companies to comply with stringent content moderation policies to operate within the EU market. This act represents a legal framework that extends well beyond traditional boundaries of censorship. It pushes companies to police content in accordance with European standards, which is basically just a proxy for NATO and US foreign policy objectives. Collectively, these frameworks mark a global shift towards institutionalizing online censorship through legal and regulatory measures. As noted by Benz, quote, "What I'm describing is military rule. It's the inversion of democracy." Building a whole-of-society solution. As explained by Benz, the censorship industry was built as a whole-of-society effort, and to combat that, we need a whole-of-society solution. According to the Department of Homeland Security, misinformation online is a whole-of-society problem that requires a whole-of-society solution. By that, they mean that four types of institutions must fuse together as a seamless whole. Those four categories and key functions are 1. Government institutions, which provide funding and coordination. 2. Private sector institutions that do the censorship and dedicate funds to censorship through corporate social responsibility programs. 3. Civil society institutions, universities, NGOs, academia, foundations, nonprofits, and activists that do the research, the spying, and collecting of data that are then given to the private sector to censor. And 4. News media / fact-checking institutions, which put pressure on institutions, platforms, and businesses to comply with the censorship demands. Benz's organization, FFO, educates people about this structure and the ways in which legislatures and the government can be restructured, how civil society institutions can be established, and how news media can be created to support and promote freedom rather than censorship. To learn how you can be a part of the solution, check out foundationforfreedomonline.com. You can also follow Benz on Twitter. I firmly believe that we can turn this situation around, if for no other reason than the fact that there are some 8 billion of us who want freedom, while those who seek to enslave us number in the thousands or tens of thousands at the most. Either way, they are clearly outnumbered. But we need to spread the word and help our friends and family understand how important our decisions are. We either support the network that seeks to take our freedom or the network that seeks to protect it. Educate yourself about what's at stake, then trust yourself to make the right decisions. This show is brought to you by Swan Bitcoin, the best place to buy with no nonsense, pure signal, buy Bitcoin, stack Bitcoin regularly, automatically withdraw it to your cold card, to your hardware wallet, whatever you use to keep your Bitcoin safe, to get it in your possession. They will literally pay the fees for it. It will happen without you having to constantly log in and think about it. It just does it automatically. If you want to get your business onto a Bitcoin standard, you want to do an employee benefits plan, you want to get your IRA and start allocating tax-free, you want to do a multi-sig vault with Swan as one of the key holders so that they can help you in the case of something terrible going wrong or losing some of your keys. You want white glove support. You want someone that you can contact at any moment to answer your questions or to help you set up your Bitcoin. You're new to the entire space and you're making a significant investment and you don't want to go in by yourself. Swan provides all of this and more. Check them out at swanbitcoin.com/guy. So there's a lot to pull away from this article. I think, and I will have a link to the Carlson and Mike Benz interview, as well as I'm going to post the video itself in our Audionauts Keat Room. So if the link ever gets lost or, it gets removed from X or wherever it's being hosted, we will always have a version of it in Keat, which is going to be really important for our discussion on the concept of a whole society solution. Because while he talks about, McCullough talks about in this article, about the idea of a government and then, you know, private sector, then civil institutions and media, I think really the important thing is that you can go, rather than going from the top down, which is what he's referring to when they talk about a whole of society solution about the military-industrial complex, about the defense industry and the corporate institutions that institute this from the top down, that the solution is bottom up. The solution is a technological one purely, in establishing networks that route around their platforms. This is why, as I have said many times, I think Bitcoin, AI, Nostr, and Holepunch, or the pairs ecosystem, are the most important things happening right now. And I specifically think the pairs ecosystem is the most under-talked about and most highly ignored and consequential of that group. Like, I think everybody is well aware that AI is a super impactful thing. I think everybody is well aware that Nostr is really, really important in decentralizing the internet protocol. I think everybody obviously is completely on board with the idea that Bitcoin, well, talking about everybody in our circles, that Bitcoin is a foundational piece of this entire puzzle to actually build financial networks and censorship resistant payment networks that route around all of this stuff. Because one of the most potent strangleholds that they have on this system is the ability to control the flow of funds. And this is something that I found interesting. A couple people recommended this article to me, by the way, and a huge thank you for pinging me for this, because I'm not subscribed to Mercola for this, so I probably would not have come across it. But I find it interesting that he didn't really talk about Mike Benz, or that's not true. I'm not sure if I haven't watched the whole interview, so I don't know if Mike Benz gets into that in the Tucker Carlson interview. And he very well may, but Mercola did not talk about the financial controls and the degree of the chokehold that is squeezed through the financial apparatus, through the corporate advertising apparatus, and all of these things, and how critically important it is for value to be able to flow around them, because value is the lifeblood of actually being able to allocate resources towards the solution. If we cannot pay for the solution, then the solution is irrelevant. This is why decentralized payment, monetary, asset rails, all of these things are so fundamentally critical to the entire discussion, to the very nature of even mentioning or bringing up a solution. Like, sure, Rumble is great to have as a YouTube alternative, but if Rumble's bank accounts can be frozen, it's meaningless. It is completely meaningless what Rumble wants to do and how strongly they are willing to fight for that if they do not have a extra or external to the monetary network, to a centralized monetary network, means of funding and acquiring the resources necessary to keep the platform alive to begin with. So I think one of the most important discussions, or the most important thought experiments, I guess, about where the problems lie is looking for the chokeholds. Is how did we all get centralized onto platforms that can now, You know, the internet, like you said, the internet started as a place built around openness and the idea of an open, decentralized network. But genuinely, how many times, like how many avenues for finding things do you have that aren't through a handful of huge centralized platforms? Like even myself, like social media is basically the center by which I traverse tons of the different things that I hunt for, so to speak, or that I find on the internet. Like I follow articles that are shared by other people on Twitter. I search things on Twitter looking for particular articles on certain topics. Most people do the same thing through Facebook, through Instagram. Most people are connecting with some other person and watching their content, and they're exposed to some product or some idea or some website that's covering something. I mean, I wouldn't know the overwhelming majority of things that I've followed and or saved from the whole COVID situation, about the Twitter files, about the CTIL files, like all of these things that Mercola even mentioned specifically in this article. I got through Twitter. I got through social media as my main avenue of connection. And for those things that I hunt outside of that, I basically use Google. Or I don't really use Google, but I use a search engine. I use some other large entity to index and hunt through what the, you know, filtering through what on the internet is going to be relevant to this topic or this discussion. And I cannot tell you how many times I have found something, or I have had some sort of piece of content or a chart or a data set, and then I can't find it again. I can't search it. It just kind of disappears, and I have a clear image in my mind of exactly what it was. And sometimes I even remember the source, or I remember something about the source, and I cannot find it. And I cannot help but think that this is on purpose. That this is on purpose. That I will specifically search for something with an obvious context, with an obvious bias. Like I'm looking for, because I know exactly what I'm looking for, I give it the bias that I think will find the article or the chart or the data point or the source. And instead, I literally get the mainstream narrative. I get a whole bunch of websites saying why this bias is wrong. And I cannot search for that context. I cannot search for that topic, which is such a disgusting thing for a couple of different reasons. It's one, it's disallowing me. It doesn't mean that I agree with it even. It's disallowing me from finding it to steel man the argument so that it can even be disproven, because they don't want you to find the data. They want you to be forced into a tiny little nook where you're only exposed to the things that they say are true. You're not allowed to get truthful information under a different context. It is the context that they are trying to control. And this, if you read something like Joseph Goebbels, and you read propaganda or whatever, they detail out why, like, this is how it works. This is the only way. Like, propaganda has to be complete. It has to be absolute, and it has to be through every single avenue, or it falls apart. It breaks apart. And while Nostr and Hole Punch and these peer-to-peer networks and things are not big enough yet, these are the only things that are solutions. And of course, Bitcoin, Lightning, and this, you know, alternative financial and monetary ecosystem, the ability to fund and source the information, the networks, and the bandwidth necessary to sustain these alternative systems. But I'm still just shocked that people don't believe it. There's so many people who still don't see it. And yet, the mainstream media, the establishment media, like how do you not see how completely ubiquitous the establishment, the corporate media is about exactly how they tailor what is being portrayed and what people, what they even talk about? They talk about nonsense issues if they support the narrative for weeks or months. How many times have they been talking about this stupid bloodbath thing, which I just watched the context just out of curiosity because I thought it was funny that Trump actually said it in the context that they claim it was, and it wasn't. He was talking about election results. Now, regardless of whether or not any of that matters, think about the fact that they will spend days or weeks talking and framing something that isn't even true in the context that they're referring to it as over something completely meaningless. But they won't spend 2 minutes talking about the CTIL files, the Twitter files, and nobody who is watching mainstream media has any idea that there is a lawsuit against the Biden administration and that you can look up the discovery documents from the lawsuit that proves that 15 federal agencies directly engaged in illegal censorship activities against the people, against people on social media, on the internet, directly and explicitly for the purpose of disallowing people from talking about a narrative that was unfavorable to the administration. Like, none of this is abstract or esoteric or theoretical. It's not conspiracy theories. It's the fact of exactly what they did, documented, recorded. There's text messages. There's private messages. It has all been released. You can read about it. You can see what the institutions are. You can see who's involved. None of this has any ambiguity whatsoever. And it's still, and the establishment media, it's nothing but crickets. Nothing but crickets. Why? Because they work for them. They are the same thing. You are waiting. If you're waiting for the establishment, the corporate media, to talk about this, you're waiting for the military apparatus to talk about all of the bad things that the military apparatus did. This is the government, the state, and this is the intelligence agencies. The intelligence agencies have the dominant chokehold on our news media. You know what's funny? You know what's really funny is the release from like Vault 7 and basically everything from WikiLeaks. What we know because of Snowden, what we know because of Manning. You know what's crazy about some of the stuff that was released is that there has never been any follow-up. Like, there's never been, like, MK Ultra was the CIA's plan. Implemented, like clearly documented what they were doing and their goal of infiltrating and having prominent executive powers at all of the major news, at all of the major broadcast stations and news media in the, you know, 70s, I think, and 80s was the extent that the documents were released. So we know 100% that they did this. You know, there's never been any, like, the CIA made a statement that we stopped doing this, that someone was punished, that this was investigated, that the head of the institution had to resign, that, you know, somebody's in prison about this. Nothing. Nothing. They didn't stop. Why would they stop? They fully and completely got away with it. That's like saying that after the 2008 bailouts, the banks stopped being irresponsible. No, they did. Why? Why would they do that? Well, the simple fact of the matter is that we know social media didn't just spontaneously decide to censor everyone. This was a set of institutions. This was a system put in place, fueled and directed and pressured by the government, by people in politics, by people in the national security agencies, to censor people specifically, even directly Mercola's account. To literally directly shut down, shadow ban Mercola and his posts that were going viral for the purposes of hiding true information. And they do not even deny that it was true. They literally call it malinformation, which we saw in the CTIL files, that what they described this as, and one of the females, what was her name? One of the heads of this whole situation, which we covered in the first episode of the CTIL files and the first episode of the Twitter files that we read on this show and detailed out. I think I did two of the Twitter files. There were like 15 of the Twitter files. In fact, I almost still just want to go back. even though I know, just know it's going to take an enormous amount of time to go back and just having an have an audio version for all of it and make it a series. It would be really cool to have, but the website is in perpetual not happening mode, and it would kind of make sense to have this on the website to just make it available to people. I mean, I guess I can make a playlist on Spotify, but yeah, regardless, I'll have I believe it's the first two of the Twitter files listed because I did audio and Guy's take on that one, and then also for the CTIL files, the first one released on that, also did audio for that. So those will be right in the show notes. If you have not checked them out, I highly, highly recommend it just to get a framework for how these people think, what they excuse. But anyway, in the CTIL files, the woman, one of the heads of one of the institutions that was around this whole thing that was kind of organizing all of this, specifically talked about malinformation, which she stated as, and there's also saved text and screenshots from, they had a Discord or a Slack group, I can't remember exactly, that they organized and chatted with, but that they specifically said that malinformation was factual information with the wrong context, which is a really obviously propagandistic and or retarded way to say that someone is looking at the data and not coming to the conclusion that we are coming to about whether this is good for them or bad for them. And for how much the NPCs squealed about, do you believe in science? There is no science without challenging data, without challenging an idea. Science is the process of challenging, of honing, of steel manning and breaking down so that you can find the truth. Society dies in the absence of open conversation. Freedom of speech is the most important thing that we could have. This is what makes Bitcoin so important. Bitcoin is a form of speech. The ability to transmit and trade and signal your value for a trade, for an association with some other person to exchange value for value, is a form of speech. It is one of the most densely possible forms of speech, of proving your skin in the game and your judgment of some situation or some use of something else. Money is simply the most important speech. And if you have free speech of resources, free control over how you direct your resources and how you direct your life, well, then you can actually secure free speech because of that, as a derivative of that. But regardless, all science, all positive discourse, all innovation will die. Society will rot in the absence of free speech. I mean, it is. It is. Is this not what we are witnessing? The destruction and the degradation of Western society because of the loss of all of the important, the critical rights that actually establish a healthy, prosperous society. And it's crazy how bad it's gotten. How much control this ecosystem, this industrial complex, this military censorship industrial complex, have completely changed the flow and access of information online. And there's an interesting line from this that kind of gets me thinking, and I've thought this for a while, and I don't know, it's so difficult to even work around to figure out how and where the vulnerabilities in this context exist, because it's specifically obscured by the tools. So there was a section from this that said, these censorship mechanisms are now embedded within the very infrastructure of the internet itself, from social media platforms to search engines and tools initially developed to protect democracy and promote free speech, such as VPNs, Tor, encryption, and private browsing modes, have all been repurposed to monitor and control the flow of information instead. And even though I am an avid user of VPNs because of the local security it gets, like for example, if you have let's say you have somebody with a Flipper or setting up a Wi-Fi, I can't remember the Wi-Fi intercept methodology that you can do in just like a coffee shop that you can mirror the settings of the Wi-Fi and you could easily take over somebody's connection. Like it's not like a novice could do it. You just kind of look up a couple of pieces of instruction online. And what's crazy is that there's not really anything that you can do. And as far as to protect yourself from that on the Wi-Fi side, on just like a software side, like it's not really the device, your MacBook or your phone can't just like look at the Wi-Fi and know which one is the right one. And in fact, if it's saved, if your device has saved the Wi-Fi details and login, well, then it's just going to automatically try to connect to whatever the closest thing is, whatever it has the best signal for. So if you're sitting nearer to that person who's trying to take over the Wi-Fi or who's giving you a dummy Wi-Fi, then you are the actual Wi-Fi device in that Starbucks or coffee shop or whatever. They're going to route through your connection. And they can just kind of fit, like, can just give you a fake website. They can give you a version of, you request Amazon, they can have it a piece of software that just automatically pulls Amazon and then just changes whatever it is that they want to change, a link or anything. It's all just surface level HTML. So in the context, like VPNs secure you, completely secure you against that sort of a threat, because you're establishing a connection, an end-to-end encrypted connection to the VPN service, so that the details even of a request are unknown. Like it just looks like garbledygook when you bring it up on Wireshark or whatever, you know, tool you're using to just kind of like watch the network for information if you're, you know, taking over their connection. VPN is literally a surefire way to protect against that, and it's really kind of crazy. So in that context, it's great. But if you don't trust your VPN provider, you're not protecting your privacy online. You're just choosing selectively who to reveal your privacy issues to, who to have all of your traffic revealed to. And if they just say, we don't log and we don't respond to police requests, you know, honestly, an institution that would be most likely able to say we don't respond to police requests and not have to deal with, you know, FBI, like if the FBI just leaves them alone or the national security agencies and stuff and the government don't go after them, well, why would they go after the one that is already sending them everything? And not your keys, not your coins. Don't trust Verify. You have nobody has a clue whether NordVPN. I mean, I use NordVPN. I've used them for a long time, but you know, I don't have a clue whether or not they're logging stuff. How the hell am I supposed to know? They told me. They told me. That's the only verification that even remotely exists. That it's just not. It's not verification. We have no idea. We are 100% trusting the VPN like we are trusting any other connection and stuff on the internet. So all we have done is shrink our attack surface to a single institution. Well, generally speaking, there's still other attack surfaces kind of around the same problem. But nonetheless, a VPN is just targeting who you are vulnerable to or targeting your surveillance system to one institution. But if that institution is still just the one, like why wouldn't the government be setting up VPN services? Like, why would they not be deeply involved in that? And I think there's even stuff, I haven't dug into it in a while, but I'm pretty sure there's stuff in like the WikiLeaks stuff that they are involved in VPN, in creating VPN businesses specifically for that. And there are probably numerous of the darknet markets that are all government run. I wouldn't disagree with that, wouldn't challenge that for a second. In fact, I'm pretty sure they had Silk Road running for a while to catch people. Like, they were just continuing to run it to get as much data as they could. There's zero indication. There is zero indication whatsoever. There is an absolute just mountain, an orgy of explicit evidence to suggest that they do not care about the law and that they do not follow the law. They simply don't want to get caught not following it. But they are criminals. Everything about this whole setup is 100% criminal, like ridiculously so. They do not care. Any indication that they are worried about the law, they are worried about getting caught, That is it, because it's embarrassing and it gets in the way of them being able to do all of the things that they do. But they are 100% brazen about it. And it makes sense to the kind of historical context they have about this. And I find this really fascinating because I think it showed, I think the clip that, one of the clips that I used about the quote, that it was the high water mark of internet free speech was the Arab Spring in 2011 and 2012. And when you had all the adversary governments, the Obama administration, Egypt, Tunisia, all began to be toppled in Facebook revolutions and Twitter revolutions. And you had the State Department working very closely with the social media companies to be able to keep social media online during those periods, Benz said. I think the crazy thing is that they realize, like, I think that was kind of the moment that it was recognized the unbelievable impact that social media was going to have around organizing people external to the normal modes of organization, the normal modes by which essentially organization was controlled, the ability to get a message out. You know, the broadcast agencies prior to the internet age, there was no confusion and there was no ambiguity about, like, the scope of what in the narrative was possible to cover, what was possible to talk about. Like, they simply controlled the airwaves. There was no alternative means for if a million people were going to hear something, it was going to be approved. There was literally no technological means to reach a million people outside of going through ABC, NBC, like going through these huge centralized broadcasting agencies. Because in the era of broadcast television, when the signal, when the data being transferred was analog, it was not digital, which means that the signal was not two-way. It was purely a broadcast medium. When you have, you know, over-the-air television, you actually have the whole scope of the wavelengths that you can even communicate on are just controlled. Like, if you're not the approved by the FCC, the approved, you know, broadcaster for this area, you can't do it. You can't have multiple broadcasters on the same wavelengths and same channels because they just clash. They just make noise. So there was a very small footprint, like, you know, like kind of like the Spartans in 300. There was like one little squeeze, like little thing, little path that they all had to squeeze through. And all you had to do was choke that bottleneck. But when the Arab Spring came along, it just showed that the situation had changed so quickly. So, like, the birth of social media was early, like 2004, 2005 is when these things really started to kick. And I mean that they were just born and known. So this was like 6 years really after social media was even becoming a thing. And immediately, this was changing the political and government powers across the planet. You know, when we look back on history and we think about the printing press and the Renaissance and the, you know, French Revolution, the era of gunpowder, and, you know, we can look back at these things and we can see how many, basically, you know, you have this new technology enter into the sphere, and suddenly it changes the entire dynamics of the game. Suddenly, the power dynamics have completely flipped on their heads, and the capacity to create a narrative, to actually get your message out, can completely, and of course, gunpowder, can completely alter the outcome of any of the previously held dynamics. You know, I think we have the benefit, that's not the word, we have the default notion that just the way the world is right now is, you know, the way it is. And it's hard to see while it's happening that we're going through an insane period exactly like that. That we're actually watching borders change. We're actually watching regimes change and social media. Like, the internet is doing the exact same thing that the printing press, the revolution that unfolded, the Renaissance period following it. But of course, the enormous political strife, the revolutions, the growth and collapse of so many different governments and, you know, monarchies and all these things, the access to information, the bandwidth to get around systems of authority and systems of censorship is a fundamental world-changing force. And whenever those avenues open up, it must be assumed, it must be without question assumed that the government is trying to plug it back up or trying to get control over whatever the new environment is, because they don't stay in power if they don't. It's that simple. Power structures change if you do no, if you no longer control the narrative, which is why I continually think there isn't the societal, the cultural revolution is downstream. The point is to have a technological solution. The point is to disallow the censorship from working. And every single time, it's to outbuild them. It's to outdesign them. This, again, is why I think Noster and Hole Punch are the most important things happening, because I think they solve two of the critical problems. Hole Punch is not web-facing. It is an entirely different connection architecture. So it is essentially, and it's built very, very similar. I mean, at least the connection and network establishment is exactly the same as BitTorrent through a DHT. So exactly like how you would connect with a torrent client and the ability to just connect directly peer-to-peer, that is how the network is run. It's just the same. They use the architecture of the connections of the BitTorrent network in order to establish a different type of data feed. So rather than static data like a torrent, it's live data that you can update, that you can, you know, send a feed with. And I genuinely think, the more and more I think about it, that while Keat has worked amazing as private chats, like closed groups, well, not necessarily closed, but closed in the sense that, like, I can't just kind of browse the quote-unquote Keat web. There's not, like, a way that I can just go find this conversation. Like, in Noster, it's just a completely open broadcast network. I can just freely look through, you know, whatever a relay is aggregating and then just follow stuff. It's Twitter, right? Whereas Keat is basically Telegram. Like, I can't browse through Telegram conversations, or at least in the UI, that's how the UX of it, that's how its restrictions and how its walls are made. Keat has private groups. In the same way, what I found interesting about how Hole Punch works and how the connection system works is that Noster is not, and this is something that I talked about with Pablo, I think we talked about it on that episode, if I'm not mistaken, or it was off the recording. I don't know. But I talked about it with Pablo, and he actually hit on something that I hadn't really thought about, is that there's nothing, again, Hole Punch is just a, or Pairs.com is a, it's a generic hosting, and it's a generic communications protocol. So there's literally nothing about it that we can't run Noster using Pairs. Like, there's no reason why I couldn't have a Noster feed on my runtime, and you have a Noster feed, and everybody else has a Noster feed, and we just connect. I just search out to follow the keys of anybody that I'm specifically following. And it would literally integrate with Noster. The singular issue being is that it would not, without a bridge, you would not be able to see the Hole Punch Noster comments and tags and data and all of that stuff on the live, on the actual internet, the web version of Noster, like with primal.net. You would have to have some sort of a relay that both are connecting to and is running a web front end relay to aggregate the information from the Hole Punch world and then broadcast it back out, host it, manage the bandwidth, whatever, to broadcast it back out to the web version. And because of this, I think Hole Punch is fundamentally more censorship resistant than Noster. Like, Noster is a brilliant way to distribute the attack surface, and it's so simple. Like Noster is powerful in its simplicity of how it works. But already the weight is heavy. I think Fiat Jaff had a post very recently, like maybe even today. I can't remember. I was scouring through a couple of notes and things that I've been saving. But Fiat Jaff had a post about publishing to a different set of relays. And if you aren't connected to a handful of very popular relays, your message just doesn't get out there. It doesn't get retransmitted. Like, he had like a huge, huge difference in where he posted his note, which essentially means if you go after just a few big relays, well, you've got a chokehold on the majority, the overwhelming majority of what anybody can see on the Nostr network. So you essentially have the same problem, the same centralization problem, which if you don't solve the client-server problem, it's kind of inevitable. The benefit of Nostr is that you can work around it and you can directly fund relays that do not censor, but it still means that the cost of exit and the cost of shifting infrastructure is very, very high. It's a very difficult thing to set up a business that is going to deal with millions of dollars in costs and try to pull in millions of dollars in revenue to cover that cost. Bandwidth on the web, like server end bandwidth for people doing enormous amounts of activity and hosting images and sharing videos, that is a very difficult and expensive process. It needs funding. It needs some sort of a monetization, or it needs to solve the infrastructure cost problem. This is why I've yet to prove to myself why this wouldn't work or why this is a bad idea. The more I think about it, the better the idea gets. Is running Nostr Pwn, like the basic protocol for signing, sharing, like the Nostr protocol, and just instead of relays, swap out relays and build it on top of Hole Punch, so that your client just connects peer-to-peer, and then solve whatever problems show up as this thing scales to 100,000, a million users, and you have 3,000 topics, like 3,000 keys that you're following. Sure, there might be scaling headaches, but I have been continuously impressed. Like, it's shocking how well the Bitcoin group works, and there's like 1,500, 1,600 people in it, and it updates very easily. All of the media is reliably there because almost always somebody is online who has downloaded it, and it will actually pass through. And that's just in the current state. They're in the process of making a data cache for just the most recent messages for the blind forwarding. So exactly the same thing that they used to solve the fact that, like, if you're not online at the same time, you can't get messages to each other. They solved that problem with the blind forwarding issue. Well, now there's going to be a blind forwarding cache. So if you upload a 10 megabyte movie, it's just going to give you a little confirmation that says, yes, it was received by the network. And any of your closest peers are just going to save it in a dedicated cache spot that, you know, it's like 200 megabytes or whatever it is for just the next GIF image or whatever. And then forward it along when the other person comes online. And it is a blind cache. It is encrypted, so they can't see what it is. It's just generic information that they're using. You can almost think about it like kind of a cost of being a part of the network, even though none of it is explicitly like this, and it's not like you have to do this. It just works better if the people do. But it's kind of like a mempool. It's just like carry around the latest messages for the people that you connect to, so that, and they do the same thing for you. So while you're offline, you get the updated messages, and while they're offline, they get it. Keet is such an incredible example of how powerful this can be, because they're hosting a chat app. They're not hosting. That's the thing. There is a chat app with who knows how many rooms. I'm in like 43 or 44 right now, with hundreds of people in a ton of different rooms, 1,000 more or more in a couple of those, tons of media being shared. I share videos all the time. I try to save stuff from Twitter that I think is going to be useful. I've just gotten into a habit, like anytime I see a video that's like remotely good or has a remotely useful piece of information that I think is important, I just save it now. I don't even save it with a name. I'm going to figure out a way for AI to go through, sort, tag, and it's just going to happen at some point. So I don't even need to save it with a name, because I can use my transcribe AI app to go through and transcribe the whole thing. And then I can just search everything through text. So I'm going to figure out how to organize this stuff. And with something like, I'll just go ahead and say it, with repair drive with what I, the project that I'm trying to build on top of this thing, I'm going to have public rooms where we can just aggregate all of this. So all of our stuff on Twitter, anybody who's got extra hard drive space, let's just pull it together in a big collection. This is part of what I want to build. And we have a couple of things coming on that front. Things that will be relevant to this show and that I hope you guys are excited about, because I want to fix the fact that this is not talked about enough. We can actually bring BitTorrent back, and we already saw peer-to-peer networks, file-sharing networks, succeed at becoming the dominant force of bandwidth, use of bandwidth on the internet. Like 80% of the internet traffic was through peer-to-peer file-sharing protocols for a minute. It was like in 2006, I think, was when it hit that peak, before it started to decline again. And I don't remember the actual statistic for the amount of bandwidth. I just know it was somewhere in, it was in the overwhelming majority range. I think we can do that again. I think we have a use, we've proved that a protocol can do this. This isn't a if, this is a it did. How do we make it do that again? Because if we can do that, we can solve this problem. Like, massively solve this problem. In fact, we can solve it better than it was solved the first time around with the creation of the internet. Then we can refocus on the privacy problem, which I think Hole Punch and Noster, people think that, you know, Noster specifically is kind of a privacy thing. And with the exception of private DMs, it's actually one of the most open non-private networks. It's kind of like Bitcoin. Bitcoin is ridiculously transparent. Both of these things are about censorship resistance. Both of these things are about enabling the ability to establish connections and make communication with other people without it being controlled, without it being filtered. And I think Noster is a brilliant start, and I think it's a brilliant, simple protocol for making this, making us be able to see that this could be a reality. But we still have a huge scaling problem, and we still have a huge monetization problem, and it is still centralizing to the degree that the distributed relay network responds to. Like, it's hard. Like, nobody's going to pay for 20 relays. They're going to pay for one service or one app to try to get a connection into the Noster network, if they are willing to pay at all. But at the end of the day, this is a infrastructure. This is a technological problem. And I think we have the technological solutions. And I wish, I'm still shocked by the number of people who just say because there's not a perfect solution, or that, like, you know, things are still rough around the edges, that they're not going to use it. And it's like, and they'll literally spend time pontificating or just kind of like grandstanding about this issue, and then not use something that is independent. I'm still surprised by how many people think that somehow they can, that they need to wait until somebody else, like, you can just use it. You use the tools of freedom, or you don't have freedom. And if you care about it, wouldn't that be the thing that you did, to just at least learn the tools that protect it? So anyway, I am out of time, but I thought this was a really great article. Thank you again to everyone who linked me to this one. A huge thank you to Swan Bitcoin and CoinKite. Links to those other episodes, the censorship industrial complex, and the Twitter files will be in the show notes, as well as our sponsors. Check them out. And don't forget to subscribe, like, boost, zap, retweet, and I will catch you on the next episode of Bitcoin Audible. Until then, everybody, take it easy, guys. The world is not sliding, but galloping into a new transnational dystopia. This development has not been properly recognized outside of national security circles. It has been hidden by secrecy, complexity, and scale. The internet, our greatest tool of emancipation, has been transformed into the most dangerous facilitator of totalitarianism we have ever seen. Julian Assange.